just can't throw it off so that the economics don't work. That's the only problem. Because then it'll just have the opposite effect.
Right.
And here's the reason why they have...
Call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this February 22nd. We're talking about a work session on 21-14 later in the session. We're going to open a work session simply for the purpose of adding a couple of amendments to the bill and then come back at some later date to deal with the bill itself. So if you're here worrying about that we're going to pass it or we're not going to pass it, neither of which are going to happen today. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2103. Madam Minister, what have we got here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what we have before us is House Bill 2103. At the request, chief sponsors are Representative Nose, Representative Rayfield, and Representative Williamson. The bill does one thing, and it permits licensed nurse practitioners to perform vasectomies.
Do you want to go down there?
No, Mr. Chair. It's okay. Taken me two terms to be able to say vasectomy without blushing very much, so I think we should just proceed with the hearing.
All right. You don't want to leave off?
No.
What was it you were saying?
Now that you go.
Exactly. No, I do not want to leave off.
All right. Would you call witnesses, please?
Sure. First panel, Jen Baker, Liz Banks, and Felicia Higgins.
From the next panel? There'll be one other panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Second panel will be Eugene Fuchs, Sarah Wickenhagen, and Sam Barber.
Okay.
Five or something.
I thought it'd be 100.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Jen Baker on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association and Nurse Practitioners of Oregon. ONA founded Nurse Practitioners of Oregon as an interest group within ONA in 1977 to enhance and sometimes protect Oregon's progressive practice for nurse practitioners. And we believe that House Bill 2103 does just that. As many of you already know, nurse practitioners in Oregon practice independently in primary and specialty care. That means they diagnose and treat, prescribe and dispense medication, interpret tests, and in all of these procedures, studies demonstrate that they have comparable outcomes to their physician counterparts. They even do some invasive procedures and maintain comparable outcomes to physicians, such as chest tube placement, bedside incision, arterial line placement, and biopsies. And in fact, a study demonstrates that even in urology procedures like ultrasound guided prostate biopsies, nurse practitioners maintain comparable outcomes to their physician counterparts across the board. Vasectomies are not qualitatively any different from the procedures that I've mentioned here today. Vasectomies are safer, less invasive, more affordable than permanent birth control options for women. And unfortunately, here in Oregon, they're underutilized because in large part, there is an access issue. Patients are waiting up to 3 months for a vasectomy appointment in both rural and urban areas here in Oregon. With proper education and training, the Oregon State Board of Nursing has determined that vasectomies are within the scope of practice of nurse practitioners. Unfortunately, a statutory barrier remains in place. House Bill 2103 aims to remove that barrier, expand access to care for patients, and provide more access to this vital family planning service, and create more fairness in the workforce for nurse practitioners. Washington State and Alaska nurse practitioners have been performing vasectomies since at least 1996, and removing this barrier aligns with the Institute of Medicine's recommendation that state legislatures act to remove scope barriers and allow nurse practitioners to practice at the top of their license to ensure that we are improving care, freeing up doctors for more complex cases, and increasing access to care for all patients.
Thank you. All three, and then we'll see if any questions emerge.
Good afternoon. My name is Liz Banks. I'm Director of Clinical Services with Planned Parenthood Columbia Willamette. I've been a nurse practitioner with Planned Parenthood for 16 years, and I am currently have been in my director role for the past five.
Are you speaking for Planned Parenthood today?
No, sir. I'm speaking as a nurse practitioner.
Okay.
But just so you know where I work. As both an advocate for and a provider of family planning and reproductive health services, Planned Parenthood takes these issues seriously regarding access and affordability. Currently, access is inhibited by a lack of providers for vasectomies. In early 2014, we had 100 men on our waiting list to receive vasectomy, and a list that length can take as long as 6 months to get through because the organ provider network simply doesn't have the MD or DO providers trained and interested in performing vasectomies. As we speak, we currently have 92 men around the state who are waiting for vasectomy, and the earliest available appointment in Portland is mid-May. Not only is this an issue of access, but it's important to Oregon's health goal of reducing unintended pregnancies that men have access to vasectomies, which is one of the most effective treatments, permanent forms of birth control available to couples. Compared with permanent birth control for women, vasectomy is less expensive, it's less invasive, and is associated with a much lower risk of complications. Despite costing much less than tubal sterilization, vasectomy is performed at less than half the rate of tubal sterilization in the United States. It's important to increase the access to vasectomy so men can take a more active role in family planning to better ensure that their contraceptive needs and that their partner their needs and their partners are being met. Making decisions about family planning is one of the most important things men can do. And to be able to prioritize their sexual health and participate with their partners in planning the family they want. This policy change is not only appropriate to the scope of practice of nurse practitioners in Oregon, but as you've heard, it's already the current scope practice in other states. House Bill 2103 would bring Oregon policy in line with the current scope of practice, with appropriate training for nurse practitioners.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Felisa Higgins. I'm the political director of the Service Employees International Union, Local 49. We represent 7,000 healthcare workers in Oregon and Southwest Washington, and we're here in support of House Bill 2103. I'm not going to repeat some of the things that the two panelists before me have eloquently stated, but we do strongly believe that for a good, high-functioning healthcare team, that each member of that team should operate at the top of their scope so that they can be more accountable not only to their other providers, but also to patients. And we believe this bill will help remove that barrier so that can be true of nurse practitioners. We also believe that patients should have access to a suite of reproductive health care services. We represent the over 200 workers at Planned Parenthood who feel very strongly that that's the case and that all patients should have that access to a reproductive suite, including men as well as women, and this helps to expand that suite of services. I think that the Oregon Nurses Association noted that vasectomies are a leading choice for married men in preventing unintended pregnancies. And the longer these wait lists continue to go on, we know that the risk of an unintended pregnancy increases. Allowing nurse practitioners to perform vasectomies would expand access, and I urge you to support House Bill 2103, and I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Are there questions, this panel?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlick. And any of you can take this question. So can you outline specifically what training nurse practitioners receive in surgery during their course of study?
Hi. Yeah, so I think we all have basic graduate training in certain procedures and study of disease and prevention and pharmacology. Many of advanced procedures or additional training happens on the job with additional didactic with a trained and experienced professional provider.
Follow up, Chair?
Please, go ahead.
Surgery is certainly much different than pharmacology. Who specifically teaches nurse practitioners vasectomy, and who certifies that they're competent in performing that skill?
My understanding in Washington State is that they have utilized physicians who were trained in vasectomy and were good trainers also to train nurse practitioners.
Representative Bueller, also you'll see in my written testimony that the Public Health Service Office of Population Affairs actually funded a program to provide education and training for nurse practitioners in both Washington State and Alaska to go through the program, work with their physician colleagues to be able to perform and demonstrate the competencies, and many health systems require that they then be credentialed to perform the procedure as well.
Follow up, Chairman.
All right, one more.
And can you give me a single randomized study showing the outcome of nurse practitioners doing vasectomies?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, we have no specific studies around vasectomy specifically, but we do believe that they're no qualitatively different than many of the procedures nurse practitioners are educated and trained to perform, and tons of studies that demonstrate that their outcomes are comparable to their physician counterparts in many comparable procedures.
I just want to clarify, there's no randomized study looking at the outcomes of vasectomy.
Vasectomy specifically, no.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I can't resist.
I wanted to follow up on the issue of training. I guess currently it's not in the scope of practice. In fact, it's prohibited. So what would be necessary to put it within the scope? Who would regulate that, and how would they set the standards, and what kind of training would be required?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenemer, Sarah Wickenhagen, a nurse practitioner and the advanced practice consultant for the Oregon State Board of Nursing, I think is on the next panel and best qualified to address
better
that.
Better choice, then. Thank you.
You got one more.
One question?
Sure.
Okay, thank you, Greenlick. So thank you for meeting with me and talking about this subject, and the sponsor also met with me, and I had one question. I know the answer to it, I think, but I think it's appropriate for the board. You've mentioned twice, and each of you have mentioned in your testimony that Alaska and Washington are states that already do this. However, my understanding is that this legislation is not apples to apples with the legislation in Washington or Alaska. You're actually asking for some legislation different than what they do. Is that correct? As far as supervision and working with the physicians, you talked about training and all that, but under this legislation, you wouldn't have that supervision element, right?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, the proper education and training standards for nurse practitioners to meet would be set by the Oregon State Board of Nursing, so it's hard to say at this point what those would be, but again, I bet Sarah Wickenhagen would be able to expand on that for you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see if I can figure out what the next panel is there. Sarah Wickenhagen, Barbara.
It's either Eugene Fuchs or Brian
Miller. This is Fuchs.
That's okay.
And there'll be one more after that, is that right?
That's right, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Go for it.
Chairman Greenlick and other distinguished members of the Health Care Committee, thank you for allowing me to appear before you. I had previously submitted a written document to you all, which I assume you've received.
Yes.
And what I'm going to do today is hit the highlights of that and bring up a couple other issues that I've discovered since then. My name is Eugene Fuchs. I live in Portland. My address is 31 Southwest Ridge Drive, Portland. I'm currently professor of urology at the Oregon Health Sciences University. I'm also a board member of the Oregon Urologic Society, and I'm the director of vasectomy services at Planned Parenthood of Columbia Willamette. I should mention
I'll
right
ask
up
you
front.
The same question. Are you speaking for Planned Parenthood?
No, I am speaking for the Oregon Urologic Society.
Good. Thank you.
I want to make it very clear that my comments and what I say today are not necessarily the opinion of the administrators at OHSU or of Planned Parenthood. I'm here representing the Oregon Urologic Society. We are opposed to House Bill 2103. We think it's seriously flawed, and it would allow all nurse practitioners to do vasectomies, at least as currently written. Every urologist will tell you that a vasectomy is the most difficult office procedure to master. This bill trivializes this important procedure that has significant immediate complications, long-term complications, and it is not 100% effective. We believe that nurse practitioners are not educationally equipped to do this procedures. And I might add that vasectomies remain high on the list of urologic procedures that end up in lawsuits. I've been teaching OHSU residents, urology residents, and family practice residents the vasectomy procedure for over 40 years. As a general rule, our residents are taught vasectomy only after completing 2 years of surgical training. But typically, these men and women complete 20 to 30 procedures under supervision before they are confident and competent to do the procedure. During that time, they will have had the opportunity to experience all the immediate complications that can occur and how to handle these serious complications. And also they learn to handle the long-term complications, most notably post-vasectomy pain syndrome that occurs in as many as 10 to 15% of men who have it. I reviewed the well-documented curriculum and the websites of over 20 schools of nursing that offer a master's or doctorate level in nurse practice. Not one of these schools offers a course in surgical fundamentals. Thus, it appears that nurse practitioners have no training in basic surgical fundamentals upon completing their formal education. Is it really in the public interest to allow nurse practitioners to do vasectomies? I might add that many of the procedures that nurse practitioners do, such as placing chest tubes and so forth, are done as part of a trauma team. There are physicians, experienced physicians around to help them and guide them through the procedure, and I'm sure many of them become very competent. In 2009, a publication appeared entitled Procedure Competency and Job Functions of Urologic Advanced Nurse Practice. They list 28 procedures commonly done in a urologic office that can be done by a nurse practitioner. There is not a single mention of vasectomies in this list. In 2015, October of 2015, another publication came out addressing the same issue, competencies for nurse practitioners working with adult urology patients. This paper makes a couple of very important points. And I'd like to quote, nurse practice has significant knowledge deficits when entering the specialty field because genital urinary issues are minimally covered in nurse practice curricula. It also says, and I quote, license differencing with nurse practitioners are held to the same level as physicians. So if they're going to be held to the same level of outcome, doesn't it stand to reason that they should also have the same level of training to do any particular procedure? And then it says, providing care to urology patients requires a thorough understanding of GU pathophysiology, knowledge of medical and surgical options, and ability to preserve the nursing role in effective patient management. And then finally, in a discussion of these procedures, it says, and I quote, these competencies are not permitted to expand one's nurse practice beyond the bounds of original generalist certification. That is, they are not a mechanism for a woman's health nurse practitioner to care for adult patients with urologic concerns, i.e. a vasectomy. We heard about access issues. In Oregon, there are now approximately 150 urologists. Most, but not all, of these men and women do vasectomies. There are also probably at least that many family physicians who do vasectomies, and there are a small cadre of general surgeons who perform vasectomies. I don't believe that access is an issue. Furthermore, I contacted every major urology practice in the state. Every single one of these practices accept Oregon Health Plan patients, so it's not an issue of culling out the good and sending the bad or the non-payers so elsewhere. So I urge you to reject House Bill 2103 as currently written. It contains no provisions to require an established level of training or supervision of vasectomies by adult nurse practice. There is no shortage of vasectomy providers in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, and Vice Chair Hayden, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Wickenhagen. I am a doctorally prepared family nurse practitioner, and my role is the Advanced Practice Policy Analyst at the Oregon State Board of Nursing. I'm here today to provide informational testimony with no formal position on this bill. My role every single day at the Board of Nursing is to determine whether or not something is within the scope of practice for an advanced practice nurse to perform. We do that simply with a very simple decision-making tool, which you have received in my written testimony. Currently, vasectomy is prohibited by statute. Therefore, there is not outcomes data in the state to support Representative Bueller's question. However, if this is removed and this bill goes forward, nurses that have the proper education, training, and certification would be allowed by this tool to perform vasectomy. Again, comparable to other procedures that advanced practice nurses perform, who learn those procedures after they receive their base education. All advanced practice nurses, once they graduate, in fact, are generalists. But then they go on to specialty areas just like our physician colleagues. There are urology fellowships, several prominent universities to include Emory, Mayo, Vanderbilt have urology fellowships for advanced practice nurses. In 2008, the American Urological Association came out with a statement encouraging urology providers to incorporate nurse practitioners and physician's assistants into their practice, and they actually have developed a curriculum to train them. It's available on their website. I would also like to point out that we are multidisciplinary. That is true. We work in teams, we work in outpatient settings, we work in hospitals, and we all work together for patient safety. Multiple studies have shown and demonstrated that nurse practitioners are just as safe, if not safer, than our physician colleagues. They're good at following checklists and protocols, and we are the most trusted profession in the country. Again, using our scope decision tree, and if this bill goes forward, we will hold nurses accountable at the Board of Nursing. We will expect that they will have education and training in the practice of vasectomy, that they will have didactic, that they will have clinical, that they will be vetted within the institutions that they work in, and that they will have privileges within that institution and bill independently for those services, so they are accountable. The board would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on House Bill 2103.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sam Barber. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. Our physicians are not opposed to nurse practitioners performing vasectomies. That said, as Dr. Fuchs elucidated in his testimony, surgery is not part of the standard nurse practitioner training. Anytime there's a request for expanded scope of practice, we want to make sure that there are two things. One, proof of good training, and two, ongoing evidence of competency. Neither of these are in the bill as written. And we would hope that they would be included in any discussion of expanding scope of practice. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Barber. Are there any questions in this panel?
Representative
Hayden?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. So same question. My question is simply, and by the way, we love nurses. I mean, nurses, I get an opportunity to work with them in a hospital setting. They do a fantastic job. My question on this is, it's been mentioned multiple times in testimony that other states do this. when you look at this legislation versus how the other states do it that keeps getting mentioned, is it identical legislation or is it different?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, it is not identical legislation because this unique statute prohibits nurse practitioners specifically as it is currently written. So it's sort of an isolated case. Most of the time, advanced practice nurses in this state are able to perform typically any procedure that they have the evidence, skills, and documentation to perform. Vasectomy is actually an outlier in this state. It is called out specifically and prohibited. Otherwise, again, my colleague, Dr. Fuchs, mentioned bone marrow aspiration, chest tube placement. None of that is called out in statute. But for whatever reason in the state of Oregon, it is. So it couldn't be exactly the same legislation, I guess, would be my answer, sir.
Would legislation be supported that kind of mimic the supervision in Washington and the supervision and the training and the interaction with the team, including a physician, in the other states?
Chair Greenlick and Vice Chair Hayden, not in the case of an advanced practice nurse. In the state of Oregon, we are independently licensed and required, again, to be credentialed and privileged in any institution we work in, whether it's outpatient or inpatient, and therefore we're individually liable for our actions. So there is no precedent within this state since the 70s for us to work under or beside a physician colleague. It happens every single day, and I have fantastic relationships with my physician colleagues when I'm in practice. But at the end of the day, I am always culpable for my own practice.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. You referenced the American Urologic Society's curriculum with regards to advanced nurse practitioners. Do they specifically include vasectomy in that curriculum?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Buehler, when I reviewed their curriculum, it refers to outpatient procedures. I can't specifically say that it examines on their website the training for vasectomies. However, I am well aware that there are fellowships all over the country that do train both physician's assistants and nurse practitioners in this skill.
So, but the answer to my question with regards to the American Urology Association advanced nurse practitioner curriculum is a no?
It is not currently posted on their website that I remember.
Okay.
Thank you.
One more question, please.
Well, sure. Thank and then you. Let's call the next witness also, so we'll have them all up here.
Oh, Dr. Brian Melhoff.
Can I ask you a question?
Go ahead.
Yeah thank
just,
you.
Can we add a chair?
Yeah, we can post.
Yeah.
One of them can.
Or Dr. Barber, would you give me your chair?
There you go.
Yeah. And this question is directed at Dr. Fuchs. I had the good fortune as an intern to watch Dr. Fuchs for 6 weeks take care of a number of vasectomy complications, and I have to admit that was a very impactful experience for a lot of reasons. Could you describe in detail some of the complications you've dealt with from vasectomy treatment over the years?
Representative Buehler.
Not too much detail.
You name it, I've seen it. I probably recognize as the vasectomy guru in Oregon. I've probably reviewed every single medical legal case that's come by in the last 25 years. I've seen everything from giant collections of blood to span a scrotum to the size of a softball or greater. I've seen men with such severe post-vasectomy pain syndrome that they rather have their testicles removed than go on. I and one of my colleagues developed the operation a vasectomy reversal to correct post-vasectomy pain syndrome, and I personally have done over 350 cases just to alleviate the post-vasectomy pain syndrome. So, the biggest problem is that the complications that occur immediately during or right after the procedure, these are the ones that a skilled surgeon can take care of very easily. You have to know how to do that.
That's more information than I wanted. Yes, please. I'm sorry. Can you introduce yourself?
I'm Dr. Brian Melhoff. I'm a urologist in Eugene, Springfield, Oregon. I'm part of the Oregon Urology Institute. We're an independent urology group, 12 urologists, a urogynecologist, and we work well with our 7 advanced practitioners. We have 6 physician assistants and 1 nurse practitioner. I don't have a lot of prepared comments, but I think in our practice, we use our nurse practitioners to do a lot of procedures, and I'm aware of the American Urologic Association trying to assist with bring more advanced practitioners into the practice of urology, because there is, frankly, a shortage of urologists in this country, so we need help. Our nurse practitioner and PAs will do all kinds of procedures, placing catheters, doing certain treatments. I personally feel that a vasectomy, even if this bill was passed and became the law, I don't think we would be doing vasectomies with our APPs. We would be doing them as our medical doctors. I'm curious about the whole access issue, because just like Dr. Fuchs said, among all of the emails from the Oregon Urology Society, it seems like everyone accepts all patients that want vasectomies. I'm unaware of an access issue. We used to have a relationship, actually, with Planned Parenthood, where we did vasectomies at a discounted rate and took care of those patients. They decided to insource that rather than outsource that. They brought in a family practice physician to do the vasectomies within Planned Parenthood, which I feel is appropriate. That's fine. I know that even that practitioner had a complication, which he dealt with appropriately and did it all by himself. I wear another hat. I'm also on the board of the large urology practice group association called LUGPA. It's a terrible acronym, but I've been on that board for 6 years. It represents 134 urology groups across the country. Some of these are quite large groups, even 60, 80 physicians. Represents about 3,000 practitioners, urologists, and all of the advanced practitioners in those practices. In a survey that I asked on an email, there are no practices that I'm aware of that are having nurse practitioners do vasectomies in their groups. So I understand that nurse practitioners can function independently, but you know, even some of my partners have given up doing vasectomies. I'm aware of at least a half dozen family practice physicians in the Eugene Springfield area that no longer do vasectomies because they feel that they just don't do them often enough or have the skill set to deal with that and potential complications. I'll give one last example. One of my partners had difficulty doing a vasectomy. He's a very good surgeon, but he did the left side, was working on the right side, and then the left side started bleeding. Immediately, tissue starts to swell. He was trying to find what was bleeding. I came in, tried to help him. We just wheeled him over to our surgery center, gave him a brief anesthetic, found what was bleeding, and took care of that. You know, one of the risks of diving in with sutures and just trying to randomly try and find what's bleeding is there's a single artery to the testicle. If you divide that or ligate that, you will probably lose the testicle and have chronic pain syndromes like Dr. Fuchs was mentioning.
Thank you, I think.
I tried to keep my graphics to a limit.
It's not a question, it's just a comment, Mr. Chair, which is, thank you. I would just point out to the members of the committee that on OLIS, a vasectomy skills checklist was provided that I believe it's from Planned Parenthood that just sort of shows what a nurse practitioner would have to sort of go through in order to be deemed qualified to be able to do this. It's not just, I think, as Sarah from the Board of Nursing sort of illustrated, it's not just something that a nurse practitioner would start doing tomorrow. There's things that she or he would have to do first before they'd be able to engage in this procedure.
I'm going to close this public hearing. Thank you all for coming to testify. Wayne will take this under advisement and open the public hearing on House Bill 2394. Madam Administrator, what have we got?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2394 is before the committee at the request of the House Interim Committee, the Health Professional Services Program Advisory Committee. This is allowing the participating health professional licensing boards to refer licensees to the impaired health professional program for an impairing medical condition that may require monitoring for safe practice and for licensees with criminal histories involving alcohol or drug-related crimes. This also directs the Oregon Health Authority to define physical health condition for the inclusion in the impaired health professional program. This has an emergency clause, is effective July 1, 2017. And we have Chris Hamilton to come and speak in support of the bill. Everybody else. We actually could probably bring up Barbara Holtree and Randy Harnish at the same time, Chris. No, then we have a panel of people against the three people against the.
Go for it.
Okay. Representative Greenlick, Vice Chairs Hayden and Nose, and members of the committee, I'm Christopher Hamilton. I'm the Monitoring Programs Director for Reliant Behavioral Health. We have continuously operated the Health Professional Services Program here in Oregon for physicians, nurses, dentists, and pharmacists since the program's inception in July 2010. We brought this consideration to you over the summer where there would be an expansion of the program that would allow for two things. One, for medical impairment of licensees that would allow the monitoring of them, which from issues brought forth by the nursing board, as well as to expand the program to allow a diagnostic monitoring period for licensees who have crimes that involve substances but don't necessarily have a behavioral health diagnosis. Currently, under the statute, it's required to have a diagnosis and a license to be part of the program. To the first part, licensees who have a medical condition that requires monitoring, currently under some boards, the only option they have for there to be monitoring in the workplace to continue the safe practice is for those licensees to go formally on board probation, which puts a brand, if you will, on the licensee's license. So the general public can look up and see that the licensee is on probation. This would allow such licensees to be in the program, to be monitored. They wouldn't participate in toxicology, but they would have a workplace monitor and would be held and adhered to their medical treatments to make sure that they are consistent with whatever treatments are provided to them medically. This doesn't require anybody to be in the program, but it gives the discretion to the boards to such allow licensees to be referred to the program for a medical condition. The second area is the diagnostic monitoring for licensees who may have crimes that involve a substance. Consider a driving under the influence charge or other crimes involving illicit substances. Currently under the DSM-5, it is possible, now that they have removed the criterion of criminal justice involvement, to have a licensee who may have one or more DUIs yet not have a finding of a diagnosis. So there wouldn't be a behavioral health diagnosis. However, under the previous programs, the HPP, the program for the physicians, there was the availability of a one-year diagnostic monitoring program. At the last survey of the national programs, health professional programs across the nation, about 20 to 25 of the states do have this diagnostic monitoring. We can't have it in Oregon as there is not the option because there isn't a diagnosis. So this would allow boards to refer individuals to the program to participate in toxicology for a period of 1 year. I appreciate listening and thanks for allowing me to testify.
Thank you. Okay.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Barbara Holtree, Communications Manager for the Board of Nursing. While the board has no position on HB 2394, we would like to provide some information for the committee.
Can you speak up just a little bit?
Oh, I'm very sorry. For the boards that participate in the Health Professional Services Program, which is Oregon's alternative to discipline program for impaired healthcare professionals, the bill would provide more options when the boards are handling a case. Current statute allows only licensees diagnosed with alcohol or substance abuse or a mental health disorder to be enrolled in the HPSP. If a licensee or applicant is diagnosed with a physical condition that could possibly affect the provision of safe patient care, The only current remedy for the board is to place that person on probation, a form of public discipline. HB 2394 would allow the board the option of placing licensees with a diagnosed physical conditions in HPSP based on the fact pattern of the investigation. The bill would also allow for a one-year monitored practice for those licensees who may be reported for a DUII conviction, but do not meet the current statutory requirements of a substance abuse disorder or mental health diagnosis to be placed in the alternative discipline program. A year of monitored practice would allow the licensee to provide evidence of their ability to practice safely. The board would like to point out one issue with the current version of the bill. As written, HB 2394 references the Oregon Health Authority as the oversight body for the HPSP program. Based on legislation passed last session, the oversight of the HPSP will revert to the healthcare licensing boards who use the program as of July 1st, 2017. So we would suggest that references to the Oregon Health Authority be removed. Thank you for the opportunity to submit information regarding HB 2394.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, Vice Chair Nose, members of the committee. My name is Randy Harnish, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Licensed Social Workers. And I'm here to identify what is, I think, clearly an unintended consequence of a Section 4 in this bill, which deletes the language regarding the definition of an impaired professional, which is removed from Section 1. That language in Section 4 amends the social workers enabling statute that gives the board the authority to require licensees to report as a mandatory reporter colleagues, other licensees who may be impaired. I think this is clearly something that we'd be happy to work with the committee to develop amendments to remedy that situation.
Okay. Are there questions to this, ma'am?
Yes, sir. I have a question.
Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have concern about the definition of physical health condition, so lines 21 and 22 on the first page of the bill. I guess I'm concerned it's a little overly broad. It says, means a medical condition, chronic or otherwise, that the Oregon Health Authority deems appropriate for inclusion in the impaired health professional program. So how would you handle a nurse who has diabetes, who has to monitor her blood sugar, or maybe someone that's epileptic that takes seizure control medication, would they be subject to this?
Chair Greenlick and Vice Chair Nose, it would depend on the facts of the case and whether or not the board needed assurance that the licensee or the applicant would need monitoring to provide assurance that they could practice safely. We have had a couple of cases where a licensee went, or an applicant actually, and the one I'm thinking of, went through her schooling and received some accommodations as she went through for her medical condition. But when it came time to be licensed, it was a severe condition, and the board felt it necessary to have that licensee on probation or on a monitoring situation, but probation was our only option at that point.
Can I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair? Would you mind revealing what that is? Because I'm concerned that this is overly broad, so that a person that has a physical ailment, all right, mm-hmm. you put them in a situation where you potentially make it very difficult for them to work, you put them in the monitoring situation. I think I'm clear about drug and alcohol impairment, right? But like, I have a limp, maybe I can't walk around as fast, so then I'm slow, I don't chart as fast, because this is the kind of thing that I worry about, like, how will this be, what's the unintended consequence of a very broad definition of what's a physical impairment.
Well, the situation that I'm thinking of was a seizure disorder where it was severe. But I can only speak for the Board of Nursing. I mean, there would need to be rules that would be written that would be defining as to what would fall into and what would not.
Okay, well, I would just say on the record, Mr. Chair, I think if the Board of Nursing is going to have that broad definition in statute, that makes me nervous.
We've got some folks coming up to oppose the bill. We may hear more about it. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Not specifically to the bill, but what is the funding mechanism for the licensee? What does a program like this cost? What's the financial burden, or is there any?
So the Health Professional Services Program is funded through licensure fees through participating boards. So currently it's somewhere around $1 million per year.
So there's not an additional fee to the individual licensee?
Not in the case of a licensee as being discussed here, but the licensee is responsible for their treatment programs that they participate in. And in the traditional sense, that would be the behavioral health, either substance abuse or mental health, and the toxicology that's provided that's required of the licensees over their participation.
This is a monitoring program that goes over whatever is the treatment program, which they are required to pay for. Okay. Representative Malmstrom.
Thank you, Chair Greenlake. as a registered nurse, I know the fee is $145, and less than, I believe, 1% of nurses would need to participate in this program. Can you tell me how much of that licensing fee is needed to do this program?
The existing program are you asking about, or the
yes.
addition?
Or what they're talking about. I mean, how much would that fee be of that $145? What percentage?
Chair Greenlake and Representative Maelstrom, I can't recall off the top of my head what the percentage of the fee is. It is for our board. It's the total price for the 1719 biennium is about $1.6 million. We have at this point approximately 86 people enrolled in the HPSP that are board referred and 7 that are self referred.
So as to the 1%, I will speak to prevalence. Our healthcare professionals will have the same prevalence for substance use disorder and mental health conditions as the general public. So at any point, 10 to 14% likely would need, and over the course of a lifetime, that would be that 14% as opposed to that 1% provided. I will attest to that.
Let's call the next panel, please. Thank you very much.
Jen Baker, James Conway, and Susan Haney. That's the third.
Yes. Be as complete as you need to make your point, but as concise as you can possibly be.
All right. I'm Dr. Susan Haney, live in Coos Bay, Oregon, and I'm speaking against the measure. Wanted to answer a little bit more about questions that the committee members have had about the cost to participants of these programs. The participants in the substance abuse program pay anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 out of pocket for their evaluation at a board pre-approved facility, and then pay anywhere from $50,000 to $150,000 for 90 days of residential substance abuse treatment at a board approved facility. They also pay out of pocket.
That's not the only option. That's not the only treatment option.
Yes, it is. There's a list of pre-approved programs. It's a closed list, and they're all very expensive, and they recommend 90 days of residential treatment for physicians. I know because I've been in the program.
90 days.
I was put in the program because I was part of the second wave, those referred because of a mental health condition. I have a long history of depression. I had a manic episode because of steroids prescribed for asthma, appropriately prescribed by my doctor and used as directed. I became impaired. I took myself off work. I notified my employer. My employer asked that I notify the medical board. The medical board threw the book at me. They kept me out of practice for 4 months. They investigated me. They publicly sanctioned my license. And in the end, they ordered me into their monitoring program. At the time, it was only for physicians with substance abuse. So I had to go through their substance abuse program. Because they knew that wasn't my problem, thank goodness they didn't force me to go through the same inpatient treatment program that the other enrollees did. I was permitted to go through an intensive outpatient program for a couple of years. It only cost me about $5,000. They have changed the Oregon administrative rules to say that substance abuse is defined as, among other things, having an adverse medication reaction. To cover my case. At any rate, the mission creep of the professionals monitoring program to include professionals with mental disorders is an afterthought. This is a diversion program for professionals with addictions and alcoholism that show up to work drunk or stoned or hungover. It's a diversion from discipline. That's the way the program was designed. That's the way the program still operates. If you do not comply with each and every recommendation that they give you, you will face disciplinary action from your board up to and including loss of licensure. For mental health conditions, especially depression, it's not a very nice way to deal with the problem.
Do you have a position on this bill? We shouldn't have anything to do with...
I said at the beginning, I am against.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is, adding mental health conditions was one overreach. Adding physical conditions is an even more broad overreach. I think it violates the Americans with Disabilities Act because it is not providing a reasonable workplace accommodation for people with physical health conditions that can do the job well if there are not additional burdens imposed on them. There's a substantial cost to the enrollees of these programs, up to and including public action, which impairs their ability to get a good job for the rest of their career. And I know personally, because I am an impaired physician. I was not impaired before the Oregon Medical Board made me that way. That being said, I continue to practice, albeit for half the money I used to make and much less job security. I work 24-hour shifts, and I hang on for all I'm worth because I still love my job, I love my profession, and I love taking care of the citizens of Oregon.
Thank you very much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
It's obviously not been an easy road.
No, it hasn't.
Jen?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Jenny Baker on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association and Nurse Practitioners of Oregon here in opposition to House Bill 2394 as written, and primarily the expansion of the program to the physical health conditions. ONA has long supported this program from day one, and we believe that it does really great work to ensure public protection, which is its fundamental purpose, and to allow nurses and other healthcare professionals a pathway to continue practicing when they're suffering from addictions or mental health challenges. However, the physical condition expansion of the program, we believe, is not necessary. We don't know of and have not yet heard of a single case in which there has been a nurse practicing where his or her physical medical condition has impaired their practice and resulted in a mistake that would need them to enter this program. I also will note the huge expense for OSPN licensees that this program already has. The implementation of this program was the largest fee increase for licensees in recent history. In the 15 budget, I believe it was $36 of the $145 licensee or relicensing fee. And certainly while we think that money goes to do good work and we support that, we worry that such a broad expansion of physical conditions would have the potential of really driving up the cost of licensure for nurses. And we also have some significant privacy concerns for licensees being asked to disclose certain medical conditions.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. I'm James Conway, LMFT, director of the Oregon Health Professionals Program, LLC. I have worked in the addiction field since 1971 and with health professionals with state and private health professional programs since 1991. We are opposed to House Bill 2394 as written. Since the early 1980s, health professional programs throughout the U.S., Canada, and now Europe have established an enviable record of patient safety and practitioner support. The OHPP leadership team, Dr. Michael Sutcher, John Southworth, and myself, have a combined 90-plus years of direct experience with health professionals. We represent one of the entities considering applying for the new contract under HB 4016, which was passed last year. We are concerned about House Bill 2394 in its present form. It was filed during the current contract development effort for the Health Professional Services Program. It declares itself an emergency bill for fast tracking. However, amendments should be considered to make this bill have a beneficial purpose for the citizens of Oregon. House Bill 2394 has a number of areas that need to be amended so the bill accomplishes a beneficial purpose. Adding physical conditions to the monitoring responsibility of the Health Professional Services Program vendor is a very good idea. Many programs throughout the U.S. and Canada provide this now. However, a selected vendor should have a requisite competence and experience because this aspect of monitoring is somewhat different than monitoring of alcohol, drug, and mental health problems. There are different considerations. An outside list of physical conditions will not work at a variety of levels. The people who have this have a labeled diagnosis, but degrees, and the different health professions may have different risk or no risk profiles around a condition. So having an agency just provide a list rather than have this be a negotiation and a communication between the HPSP provider and the referring board will be problematic. The bill as written, they put a 2-year limit on this, but there are many of the conditions that are currently monitored in other states really require a lifetime of monitoring, just if not the safety, the perception of safety. For example, a colleague of mine who ran the Alabama program monitored a one-armed physician. You know, and they did it well, did it successfully, required a lot of accommodation, and it's continuing to work today. So you're not going to, OHA is not going to put that on a list. They're going to put general conditions or conditions like Parkinsonism or diabetes, and again, it won't create the case-specific information that is needed for an evaluation.
I'm going to ask you to wrap up. Have you submitted a written testimony on that?
No, sir. No, Representative Greenlee. Am I going too long?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's not just you. It's that we've got 3 more bills to deal with.
Okay.
I'm getting a little antsy.
Okay. To be very concise, we believe that the bill needs an amendment that takes out OHA as an oversight in this situation. The intent of House Bill 4016 removed and transferred oversight responsibility to the 4 participating healthcare licensing boards. So we oppose this bill as written. Thank you for your time.
I appreciate that. Thank you guys very much. I'm going to close this public hearing on House Bill 2394. and open a public hearing on House Bill 2552. Madam Administrator?
Well, Mr. Chair, this is House Bill 2552. Chief sponsor is Representative Hack, so I will let her present to the committee.
Excellent, thank you.
Okay.
Chair Greenlee, is it okay?
Yes, and we have...
That would be wonderful. It's always good to have somebody protect you when you're out there.
Well, he's a constituent, very passionate about this issue, and he also helps out in my office. So, Chair Greenlee and members of the committee, State Representative Jody Hack, and I have the pleasure of bringing to you House Bill 2552. Sandy, I don't know, did you already go over what this is?
I didn't. I was going to let you do that, Representative.
Oh, okay. Let's see if I can find it in here. House Bill 2552 requires the Oregon Health Authority to operate on each campus of the Oregon State Hospital a facility to provide short-term mental health treatment and residential care. It authorizes peace officer to take persons in immediate need for mental health treatment to state hospital short-term treatment facilities. As written, obviously, I can't say that this bill is perfect in its form, but I do want to say thank you to Chair Greenlee for giving this bill the opportunity to be heard. I realize this has a rather large fiscal and given our budget situation, probably is not going to be able to be moved this session, but I do think that it's worthy of being heard because of its merits and just the importance of our mental health folks. And the reason that I brought this forward was because I toured our state and visited all of our correctional facilities, our jails, and kind of took traveled from the jail to our emergency rooms and so forth when I found out that a lot of our mental health folks were in crisis and ending up in our jail systems and our ERs, and just began to do some investigation and tried to find out why that was and what we could do to possibly prevent some of that. I was blown away at the numbers of folks that were in our community that were suffering from those lack of those services. Fortunately, Marion County has been fortunate enough to be able to utilize some of the OHA grants, and we've been able to provide some wraparound services through local psychiatric crisis centers and mental health clinicians in our jails, and clinicians that team up with our patrol officers to respond to mental health crisis calls in the community. And according to our sheriff, we have been able to decrease some of the crisis services through our jails and our hospital and some of those in our ER. However, not all of our counties in Oregon have the ability to provide these services. My understanding is that the state used to have regional crisis centers, but we did away with those. If times were different, I would have an amendment to this bill and ask that we bring back those regional services, because I am so passionate about taking care of our most vulnerable. At least, though, the issue needs to remain an important one, and one that we should always be working to provide more and better services. Our most vulnerable deserve better, and many are forced into jail systems and into our ERs, and it's continuing today all across our state. We can find and must continue to look for and invest in services to provide the best for our most vulnerable. So again, I just appreciate you, Chair Greenlee, and your willingness, and vice chairs, to hear this bill and to recognize that this still is an important issue and will continue to be. And
we're not going to give up on this problem either.
No, I know it. And I just appreciate you taking the time to listen and to hear a few other folks that are extremely passionate about this issue as well. So thank you.
Please.
Thank you, Chairman, and everybody. My name is David Beam. I'm an advocate for a special needs population in Marion County. I work with 300 disability people in Marion County. Our can't read and write in the state, our do go to jail once in a time. A lot of them are homeless, don't got nowhere else to go. I had a drop-in center in this town, and it did work for 6 months, trial, and it did work, and we ran out of funds. We couldn't get it going. And people out of Fairview had to go on a drop-in center every day, and counseling was there, police and fire was there on call form. All the group homes would be involved in the state. So it did really work. Now, I'm the first one in the nation who got this done with Vicatia, got this started. Bob Straw helped me on it. Goldsmith worked with me on it. Barbara Roberts worked with me on it, and she liked what I'm doing. So I really, really like to see this done for the state.
My office now,
and I work with her, and I worked with the governors, every governor we had in the state of Oregon.
You keep her on the straight and narrow?
He does.
Yes, and...
keeps me running, don't you?
I helped her get elected.
Yep.
There you go. That's the important one.
I want to ask you something. This is serious. You don't have a disability person in the governor's office, special needs population. To be the first one in the nation would have that for a special needs population, have like emergency. You don't have that. I asked Kate Brown that. I would ask the state senators, every one of them, why come you don't have disability person on that? So that's what I'm asking. Get a drop-in center. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We need it. Bad. Thank you.
Any questions? We have
two more people, Mr. Chair.
Well, why don't you call them up? And we'll...
Okay. Denise Bowles and Dr. Bill Dalton.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sabrina.
Great Thank
job.
You.
Great job.
Okay.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Denise Bowles. I'm here to represent Salem Health. Salem Health is an OHSU partner and comprises of Salem Hospital, West Valley Hospital, and clinics throughout the community. Salem Health is a not-for-profit hospital licensed for 454 acute care beds and functions at a level 2 trauma center. But one of our unique distinctions is that we're the busiest, not only the busiest ER or hospital in the state, but we're also the busiest ED from the Canadian border to LA. So we have quite a bit of people coming through our emergency departments. Representative Hack asked me to come here today and just share a little bit about what that looks like on a psychiatric trauma crisis situation. The last 6 months in the Salem ED, we've seen 1,623 patients. The average length of a patient coming to the emergency department in Salem is about 3.5 hours. The average length of someone coming in crisis ranges between 19 and 26, depending on if they're going to be transferred to an inpatient facility. I talked to our director in the emergency department that specializes in this, and she gave me the following information. I just really wanted to share this with you so you had an understanding of what this looks like. Patients are occupying our treatment rooms that are not really receiving the mental health needs assistance that they need. They need verbal interventions, use of oral medications, input regarding their medicine, experiences and preferences, and support services. They wait for mental health evaluators to determine if they require admission. They wait for a bed at another facility without receiving treatment. In many cases, psychiatric symptoms will escalate during their time in the ED. Requiring medications or restraints, which is not a pleasant experience, to prevent harm to themselves or to others. This is not the ideal plan of care for this population. Basically, we end up boarding patients. The ED will keep them safe until they can get admitted or transferred to an inpatient psychiatric unit. But as you can see from the data, that takes an average of 26 hours to get them there. We've had some patients wait as long as 35 to 67 hours to get started on treatment, again, because of the lack of facilities, not just in our community, but throughout the state. It's not unusual for juveniles to be on suicide watch for 3 to 4 days in the hospital, in the emergency department, in order to get them stabilized and keep them safe and find a place for them to be able to go. In order to keep the population safe, we're averaging 1 to 2 staff a day that will sit and watch these patients because they pose a threat of harm to themselves or others. This pulls our staff away from other emergency needs within the busiest ED in the state. the staff compensates for this, but in essence, they are forced to work short-staffed. And there are additionally, there are higher incidences of assault and injury with staff with patients in this population.
One.
We do have the Salem Health Psychiatric Medicine Center on our campus, as well as the Marion County Psychiatric Crisis Center, which they, separate from us, go through, she told me, about 2,000 in the last 6 months. So there's just, we're a high-needs community, and there is a lot of dialogue, a lot of great things happening, but too many people are not getting the help they need in the time that they need it. So thank you very much.
Yes, please.
Questions for you?
Oh, hi.
Hi, I'm Dr. Bill Dalton. I have been a community mental health program director for almost 30 years, served as the head of NAMI Oregon, and have been an advocate, maybe not quite as long as David Beam, but I've been out in the communities in which I've been fortunate to live. Also a consumer of mental health services. I refer to myself as consumer light in that because I've had excellent mental health services, largely because of good insurance. I have never been in an inpatient facility, so I always get up in the morning and sort of thank the good Lord for that. I've been around with the mental health program here in Oregon since 1976, when I assumed the administrative leadership for a mental health program in Josephine County and subsequently also public health. So mental health and the struggles as mental health relates to the budgetary struggles that you all have is nothing new to me. I'm here today to thank Representative Hack for resurfacing an issue that I have lived with and seen, particularly as a provider and an administrator of services for, well, 4 or 5 decades. The whole issue of appropriate intervention, stabilization, referral is something that has been with us pretty much forever, will probably be with us, as the excellent testimony from Salem Health indicates. We're both fortunate and unfortunate here in Marion County. We have some excellent facilities. We also draw people who need these services. For those of you like Chairman Greenleck, who got back a long ways, you remember that we had a Maples unit at the state hospital, which specifically tried to address the local needs here in the Marion Polk County area for those people needing short-term intervention, acute services, stabilization, and then referral. This is a very high priority need. This is a very, very difficult budget session within which to ask the legislature to address that. I did serve on the Governor's Commission for Psychiatric Inpatient Services back in 1988, still proudly have that report. Many of you have seen it. Some of you still have it on your bookshelf. It was an excellent report, and it was enthusiastically embraced and endorsed by the legislature, that was not a partisan issue. It was embraced by both Republicans and Democrats because they recognized the need for local intervention services. Representative Hack has indicated a need for possibly centralizing those services, making them available here in Marion County. But she, like myself, is very aware that the best kinds of services that we could have to address these issues are local services, and in very, very rural communities, maybe regionalize those services. We have an excellent history for those areas that have been able to develop those programs. I think Bend and Eugene have reason to be proud over the years for what they have done both in the public sector and the private nonprofit sector. Obviously, we need to provide the supports to allow those to be supported, and in those areas where they're not existent, to be created. My handout to you today is put together in light of the realities of the budgets that you're going to be dealing with across all of the agencies and organizations and services for which you have responsibility. My first plea has to be for Medicaid. We're trying to fill a hole that's, what, close to $800 million because of the ratchet down in terms of federal support. My plea with you is to address that issue, because otherwise the tumble down on facilities like Salem Health, Judicial Corrections, is just going to be overwhelming and will come back to haunt us, both as citizens and legislators. I also want to put in a special plea for what I refer to as supportive housing. I've seen some really excellent work being done here in Marion County under the leadership of Salem City, working with Kaiser. We need congregate housing, co-located housing, where people who have been stabilized can find a living environment that is safe, a living environment that is supervised, and a living environment that has access to the kind of professional staff, case managers are close to my heart because of my own experience, who can provide 24/7 intervention and stabilization so these people don't just cycle right back into our system. Let's take a look at what we can accomplish here in Salem. Try and provide a model that can be replicated elsewhere. I've made a number of other points that I hope you will look at briefly and consider as a wide variety of mental health issues, funding and otherwise, come to your attention. But
you
again, Representative Hack, thanks so much for bringing this up. This
have
is
you
a perfect
submitted
time.
That to the committee?
Thank you.
Have you submitted your written recommendation?
Yes, you should have received a brief outline. For a loquacious person, I tried to be very succinct.
We expect to hear from OHA on our community mental health system. We have a USDOJ agreement that really needs to push us in this area. We've got a new center opening in Portland that should help some. But it's a huge problem, and we recognize it. Thank you very much.
And thank you.
Mr. Kenny Geyer.
I know you're short of time. I'll save it. But there will be other mental health bills that are coming up, and I look forward to talking them over with Representative Hack, now knowing your interest in this, and I hope that we'll have more discussion when those come back.
That's great.
And the support
haven't
of
been
housing,
dropped yet.
The supportive housing in your other committee.
Supportive housing probably will come here. I think it came here last time, so that hasn't been dropped yet. I believe NAMI has a supportive housing bill, as they have done in the past. And then we have a couple of ones around hospital discharge and continuity of care that I know Representative Bueller is involved in, and I'm hoping some other people will join on before that gets dropped. So,
great. Chairman Greenlick, may I make one comment?
Yes.
It's a phrase more than a sentence, but let's cheer on our coordinated care organizations. I know we're new into this, and they're still struggling to get their feet under them, but that whole concept of bringing behavioral and physical health care together under one roof does nothing but substantiate the kinds of progress that we're trying to achieve here.
Yeah, they have a long ways to go.
They
to
do.
Get there.
But don't give up on it.
We're not giving up on it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2552. An open public hearing on House Bill 2754. Administrator, what have we got?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2754 is sponsored by Representative Barker. It requires a newborn child with a hearing loss to be referred to a health care provider for the purpose of diagnosing whether the infant has cytomegalovirus. Directs the Oregon Health Authority to compile and disseminate education information on congenital cytomegalovirus. Mr. Chair, we have Amy Nelson Horton. Thank you. To testify on the bill.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Thanks. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Amy Nelson Horton, and my family and I currently reside in Milwaukee, Oregon. Can you hear me?
A little
closer?
Louder.
Is that better? Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry. In November 2002, my son Nolan was born severely disabled due to congenital cytomegalovirus, or CMV. Nolan was silent when he was born. The nurses had to rub his chest to initiate his first breath. Sorry. When the doctor handed him to me for the first time, I remember he looked yellow and was covered in little red dots. The nurses assured me that he had a rough ride during delivery and that it was common for newborns to have these little red dots, also known as petechiae. A few hours after Nolan's arrival, another nurse came into the room and informed me that Nolan had failed his newborn hearing screening. Nolan's hearing was tested multiple times before we were discharged from the hospital, and the results were all the same. The next 2 weeks are a blur. Nolan was diagnosed with CMV at the Salem Hospital and then transported to Dornbecker Children's Hospital, where I was told that the CMV was rare and that Nolan didn't have the brain capacity to sustain life. The infectious disease specialist then advised me to consider placing a do not resuscitate order and gave us the devastating news that it would be hopeful if Nolan made it to his first Christmas. Nolan was sent home and placed on hospice care. For weeks, we watched him struggle to survive and wondered how long we were going to have him with us. Weeks turned into months, and months turned into years, and thankfully, Nolan saw his first Christmas and many more. He is now 14 years old.
Wow. Yay, you brought a picture.
I have been told that I contracted CMV early in my pregnancy due to the enormous impact that his brain suffered from this horrible virus. Nolan has pockets of fluid and calcifications where there should be normal brain matter. Nolan can't sit or stand on his own. He is fed through a G-tube. He has seizure disorder. He is profoundly deaf. He is blind. He wears braces on his feet, and he is referred to as a spastic quadriplegic. It has been a rewarding yet intense 14 years. A mother should not have to welcome her baby into the world with a death sentence. Our journey has led me here today because as my knowledge about CMV expands, I can no longer keep quiet. CMV is a public health issue, and education along with screening is necessary. According to the CDC, congenital CMV is the most common viral cause of birth defects and developmental disabilities in the United States. More children will have disabilities due to congenital CMV than other well-known infections and syndromes, including Down syndrome, fetal alcohol syndrome, spina bifida, and pediatric HIV/AIDS. It is the leading non-genetic cause of childhood hearing loss, and 400 children die from CMV every year. One of the highest risk groups is pregnant women who have not yet contracted CMV prior to pregnancy, as they will possibly pass the virus to their unborn child, causing potential birth defects. The lack of information about congenital CMV during pregnancy has impacted me personally. If I would have known about CMV before or during my pregnancy, I would have altered my behavior to prevent the transmission to my unborn child by not sharing food or drinks with toddlers, hand washing, and avoiding contact with saliva when kissing the child. Unfortunately, these seem like simple hygiene tasks, but I, along with many other pregnant women, did all of these because of the lack of information and education regarding the transmission of CMV and the potential complications associated with CMV. I have embraced Nolan and this journey that we have been blessed with. I would not change the path that our lives continue to explore, but together with your support of House Bill 2754, we can change the course of another baby's life by reducing the risk of congenital CMV infection. Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members.
Tell us very specifically, the function of the bill is to make it a medical rule that when a child fails two hearing tests, two newborn hearing tests, the child is automatically referred to a physician for tests at that point. Mm-hmm. What tests would be available at that point?
You can screen for, Chair Greenlick, you can screen for congenital CMV within 21 days of birth, and you can do it through saliva or urine, which are cost-effective and covered by insurance.
But it's not happening frequently, is that?
It's not happening at all, to my knowledge, unless a child presents other health complications and then they're referred to their primary.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Thank you for being here, and I enjoyed my time. I got to speak with you. I think it's important that you also clarify why the 21 days is so critical.
You can, Chair Greenlick, Representative Hack, it has to be done within 21 days to see if it is congenital or not. After 21 days, the test can be skewed, and they're not sure if the baby maybe contracted a secondary infection. Dr. Schles from the University of Minnesota sent a letter in support of the Oregon bill. He is a graduate from Oregon Health and Sciences Medical School and Dornbecker Children's Hospital. He studies CMV and infectious disease.
I don't think we got that letter.
Did you email that to us?
If you have a copy of it, maybe. Do you have a copy?
I do.
I
have
the copies. If you leave it with the
I will.
Assistant, we'll distribute it.
Sorry. So the American Academy of Pediatrics states that neonates with symptomatic congenital CMV disease with or without central nervous system involvement have improved audiologic and neurodevelopment outcomes at 2 years of age when treated with oral valganciclovir, and it gives the dose for 6 months. So children that are diagnosed, if they fail their newborn hearing screening twice, and they're diagnosed with congenital CMV, their outcomes are much better than children that aren't.
So just a clarification. Thank you, Chair. So if they're diagnosed within 21 days, then they get the treatment, and mm-hmm. the treatment is up to the physician, obviously, but it's a six-month treatment, and their outcomes are far, far greater than if you miss the diagnosis within the first 21 days, correct?
Within the 21, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Thank
Other
you.
Questions? Well, thank you. We'll take this under consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2754 and open a work session on House Bill 2114. The only purpose of this work session is to consider two amendments to the bill that will improve it but still not make it necessarily acceptable to some people, but taking out the criminal issues and dealing well, I think there are others, and dealing with the assurance that the Dash-3 amendments, that it doesn't include long-term care facilities, will at least have us in considering over the next period what the actual bill is. So could I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, you can. Can I move both amendments in one motion, or do I have to do them separately?
One at a time.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would like to move the following -1 amendment to House Bill 2114, dated February 13th, 2017.
Representative Nose moves the -1 amendments dated February 13th, 2017. To House Bill 2114. Is there any discussion? That's the bill that takes away the criminal penalties.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is. It's your amendment.
Yes, sir.
Just a comment. It's a part of the amendment that's not necessarily for me mean support of the entire bill.
I hear that.
Okay.
Okay. Is there any other discussion? Is there any objection? The amendments.
Oh, did you object?
I'm sorry. Could you clarify that, your motion?
It's adopting the -1.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay.
-1 is a part of the bill. Another motion?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we adopt the -3 amendment to House Bill 2114, dated February 22nd, 2017.
Representative Nose moves the -3 amendments to the bill dated February 1.
22nd.
22nd, 2017. That's the amendment that simply adds to the list of exclusions people in long-term care.
That's correct.
There's apparently a -2 somewhere, but nobody's heard about it yet.
The mystery will reveal itself.
Is there any discussion on the -3 amendment?
Thank you, Chair. Same comment. Support of the amendment does not necessarily support the amendment.
Absolutely. Job. It's true of me, too.
Me too.
Yes. Do we have to call the roll?
No. No objections. So moved.
Okay.
I close the work session on House Bill 2114. The issue with 2114 is not whether people think this is the right policy. The question is whether it ought to be exactly or whether something else ought to be. We're having a lot of discussions about how to deal with it. Madam Minister, do we have anything else?
Mr. Chair, if I may just remind the committee that we're meeting at 8 o'clock Friday morning. We have an informational.
Should be a very interesting meeting. We're going to be looking at the questions of what are the levers that deal with the high cost of health care to try and give us some advance information about what's going on. If you happen not to be in Salem that day, you might want to listen in on the streaming. I think it's I think it should be a very interesting session. And we're going to be dealing with a bunch of things like hospital community benefit and provider taxes and a bunch of other things. This stuff should be helpful for us. Yes, sir.
Do you assume that people watch this instead of cable TV at home at night?
It's not X-rated.
Yeah, no. Well,
you can watch
well,
it.
That's second. Well, we'll see. Yeah. I don't think that was X-rated.
No.
We are adjourned. Thank you.
No.
We are adjourned.